Well, if you guessed that that was John Coltrane, you win. You get a round-trip ticket to wherever it is you want to pay to go. That was John Coltrane on tenor sax with Blue Train. It's the title track from his second solo album that went gold when it was released in 1957. You can tell I like all these old classics. I love them. Lee Morgan also on trumpet, Curtis Fuller on trombone, Kenny Drew on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Philly Joe Jones on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, June the 9th, 2015, and I aim to pick up from where I left off with you yesterday. Just to give you a heads up, our studios are in the final stages of getting ready to serve us better. The innards, the technical wires, and all the other things that make techies really happy are being finalized even as I speak. And the studios, I haven't seen them. I hope to see them soon. But I'm told they are just incredible. More space to do more things. And it's a sign of progress, great progress, that PRN is growing and we are in a space that we could be even more productive and to suit you and your informational needs. So that's happening. In the meantime, as you know, I love taking phone calls, but we have to hold on for a while until all the wires are tested and retested, and that should be done by the end of the week, I'm told. So we'll be able to reconnect really soon. But for the meantime, I'm afraid it is just me talking. And I wanted to say these things anyway, so bear with me this week. I'm trying to put out some ideas for you to cogitate upon and to meditate upon so that when we do reconnect, we can return to these discussions for further amplification. Well, I talked yesterday about the need to do a reality check of our own and to develop our own systems by which we measure the so-called progress and reforms that are being made, that we're told are being made. And my contention is that this has nothing to do with an earnest and sincere desire to change the society and its culture. It is mainly meant as a palliative, a gradual non-essential approach, if you will, because the thing that matters most is that the systems remain the same. And we know that the system that was initially designed was just horrific in its psychology, even. This notion of who is superior to whom by virtue of skin color, the vestiges of this kind of psychotic way of looking at the world, that there is automatic preference to be given to people on the basis of what is perceived to be their racial superiority, and everybody else has to essentially fit into that kind of a mindset. And to all these years, to pretend that there is a whole other reality other than the one we know exists and other than the one that we experience every day. We are supposed now to take on that psychosis. We are supposed to take on this delusion and grapple it onto our breasts with hoops of steel, as my father used to say. We are supposed to take ownership of this craziness. And despite everything that tells us that life is different and reality is different, we're supposed to believe that there's progress, that this society means everybody well, that everybody's created equal, and all that other junk that we are told to believe. And there are people who do believe it. But I'm saying that the time has long since passed for us to grow up and come to terms with the reality we know. And when we embrace the idea that we actually ultimately are responsible for our own destiny in many, many ways, we really are. Yes, you know, there are other systems that do have their impact and portions of control over our lives. But what we think, this thing we called our mind, our brain, this extremely valuable piece of real estate, is what's supposed to guide us in our day-to-day decisions and actions. And here, this piece of real estate that we have between our ears, that everybody wants control over, this is where we ought to exercise total sovereignty. We master this piece of real estate. We own it. It's ours and ours alone. And in your brain, in your mind, you at least ought to begin the process by now of accepting certain things as true. Never mind what you're told, but your reality is also valid. Your historical memory is valid. And when these things are telling you and showing you that without, beyond a shadow of a doubt, you have good reason to distrust this so-called system, you have good reason to do so. Why? Because statistically, it shows itself time and again to lie, to deceive, to do evil things, to ruin lives, to destroy, and to create an untenable situation that ultimately is inhumane. It has nothing to do with all these highfalutin ideals that are spat out at us all the time. This business that we're all created equal, and this is a land of freedom and justice and whatnot. We have ample reason, ample evidence to back up a natural suspicion and a natural tendency to reject any such claims. Statistically, we are on solid ground in taking that position. But I speak here particularly to those who identify as members of oppressed classes. Now, the basis of your oppression, it seems to me, this is logical, the basis of your oppression is the basis on which you organize. Okay? I believe it was Du Bois who said that. This is not one of my uniquely minted sayings. I don't know whether it was Du Bois or whether it was someone else. I believe it was Du Bois who said that. The basis of your oppression is the basis on which you organize. And in the United States, for a large percentage of people, the basis on which we therefore ought to be organizing is on the basis of race, discrimination, and oppression. Just today, you know, we have horrific news coming from all over the country about how people are struggling in these different parts of the country with issues of race that ended up claiming lives. I want to discuss one in particular, and to illustrate the point I made just yesterday and that I had made before about fixing this society when this society has to confront the consequences of its psychotic behavior, its inhumane and demonic behavior. It claims to say, well, you know what, we ought to fix this. We ought to have some reforms. And so the media go into action, media organizations go into action, and they get us ready for the whole idea of changes are coming. They're going to fix it. And they're going to call it reforms. But our fixation should be instead not on the reforms, because we know that they will be very, very little. They will be, these are gradualistic approaches to long-held, historic, deep-seated fractures in our society. All of it completely man-made. But the thing is, because it is politically expedient to be seen as a progressive person, a humane person, therefore the system is progressive and humane, we hear about reforms. And we are supposed to detach this now. We fix the issue of reforms to the leader who is talking about these reforms. And we dismiss the fact that it comes at the expense of somebody's life. And usually in our experience, this is the historical memory that many people have. Now, major society may choose to dismiss it as being irrelevant or just incidental to the fact that we should move as a nation. But that shouldn't bother you if you identify as a member of an oppressed class. Don't let that bother you. Be real, though, about the consciousness of where you belong. And therefore, your obligation, in fact, I would say your duty, to respond accordingly. Whatever anybody wants to think, let them think. That's not your trouble. So we have this young man, Khalif Browder, 22 years old, who kills himself. And what emerges in this story is that Khalif Browder had spent some time at Rikers Island, the prison complex in Rikers Island. He spent 3 years there. What is also important to understand about Khalif Browder is that he never committed a crime. But he was held at Rikers Island for 3 years without a trial, without any kind of justice. He just was sent to oblivion He was just, you know, we could take some mother's and father's son and just put him someplace for 3 years, and whatever happened to him, we don't have to really account for. Well, it turns out in the 3 years that Caliph Browder was there, he was subjected to incredible torture and pain under the system that was supposed to, A, deliver justice by not having him there in the first place. And once they had him there, it was their job, their duty, to safeguard and protect his life. But instead, he was tormented. He was segregated. He was subjected to horrific treatment. And he wasn't singular in this response, but he was singular in the sense that he simply could not take it. Even after he was finally released, again, no crime committed, but he was there for 3 years. And his family and friends said that he was never the same. He literally became mentally ill in prison. He entered at age 19. He left it at age 22. And he was dead by his own hand because he just could not take this pain anymore. Well, just so you know, Rikers Island is one of the largest jails in the United States. As many as 15,000 people can be housed at Rikers Island in New York City. And Rikers Island has its own reputation as a particularly brutal facility where people who are put there literally have to be afraid for their lives. This is not news. As long as there has been a Rikers Island is as long as this reputation has stood. So this is not an unknown scenario. But yesterday, the progressive mayor of New York City, William de Blasio, made an announcement. Because he is, after all, progressive. He's a progressive mayor, and he's there to do progressive things, elected by a large segment of the people wanting progressive leadership, including people who have had some knowledge and some direct experience, even, with what happens at Rikers Island. So, Mayor de Blasio stages a news conference, which is the best way for people to communicate their ideals these days. And he announces he's going to initiate not just an investigation into this, but reforms. Reforms. We don't know what those are. But it is enough, it's sufficient, politically sufficient, that such a thing is articulated. So he articulated it. I am here, this is outrageous, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to initiate reforms, okay? The meantime, what happens to the family of Caliph Browder? What happens, what do we say? What is the responsibility for this life? What is the degree of obligation for this life that ended at age 22. More importantly, I want you to appreciate picking up from where we left off yesterday. The issue is no longer that he died. That's now a technicality. It is merely the means by which the subject is addressed. Caliph Browder is Caliph Browder. simply exists in this entire story as a kind of, he makes a cameo appearance in his own story. He is not important. What's important is reform, as if we are to accept and we are to anticipate and trust that there actually will be reforms. The young man is dead. And here's worse. The worst part is nobody is paying for it, or nobody will be made to pay for it. And that includes the police and detectives who ended up putting him in jail. That includes the prosecutor. You're talking immediately here about prosecutorial, not misconduct, but this is just vile, vile, illegal behavior that puts this young man in prison in the first place. The judge, the whole system is not going to suffer a thing. These people have gone on with their lives. They're making good money. They probably they've moved up that food chain. Khalif Browder was a notch on their belt, and they were able to say, "Look, I put another person in prison. That means I'm effective." Nobody is going to jail that caused this young man to be in jail in the first place for a crime he did not commit. The system knew it, but kept him for 3 years. And in slow, painstaking ways, snuffed out his life, and they made him do even that to himself. See? So the consequence of this series of illegalities ended up being suffered by the victim. This is serious oppression here. This is what I'm trying to tell people. This is how the system works. We do injustice to you, and then we get you to do further injustice to yourself. And all the while, we have the ultimate authority and power to persuade not only the world, but especially you, that you are at fault. There's something wrong with you. I bring this to your attention because we know Khalif Browder is one of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of young black and Latino men that the system sets up and feeds upon and systematically breaks them down, destroys their lives, destroys that many pieces of the communities to which they belong. And they've been doing this for decades. So to extend any credibility to such a system means that you too, your brains are addled. You've gone soft in the head. We are all parts of systems. We all belong to systems. Khalif Browder had a system. He had friends. That's a system, a peer system. He was part, I'm sure, of some family. Yes, he was. So that's a family system. He was part of a community. That's a system. So all these systems are interlocking. And all of these systems, broken as they are, imperfect as they are, nonetheless sustain life. They're broken, though. And our job is to reject the system that creates these broken systems. Reject them utterly. Or, if you are engaging with these systems, to be very clear as to how much or how far you want to go with them without being consumed by them, because they're not meaning any good. Systems are systems. And the nation system, the governmental system, the legislative system, these all are parts of the overarching system that has created and continues to create the mess that we have to deal with. These are not especially wise people. These are not especially moral people or even good people. They're not even dealing with us as people. They're dealing as a system, as a collective that has a particular agenda in mind. And they sign on to the system. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white or polka dot. You pledge your allegiance to the flag. And the flag is the system. We have a black president, allegedly. Barack Obama. I mean, need I say more? You look at the state of affairs with education and with employment and with safety and with all the basic things, the six basic things I said we need to measure in terms of how you judge a democratic society, failing spectacularly in every single category. And yet, the system requires our participation to vote. And what do? We vote. We vote even as our schools are being shut down and our children are being taught by unqualified or underqualified people in schools that should be broken down to the last brick and rebuilt for human inhabitation. We had, as I have so many years, I forgot the name of that school in Harlem, with no windows. With no windows. A child does not see natural daylight going to that school. Or we had cases in children, in which children are studying in what used to be the bathroom. And they're sitting on the floor. And we tolerate that. So what do? Following again on yesterday's theme of being very clear about what system you belong to and beginning the process, or perhaps speeding up the process, hopefully, of constructing systems that speak specifically to our own needs, that we control, that we design, that we operationalize. That's not an easy task. Because the reality is, you have to deal with people whose psychological defenses have been worn down to the point, in some cases, where they have no defense systems in place. They believe everything that is told them. And even though they see the truth, they continue to place their faith in a system that is designed to annihilate them. Harriet Tubman's famous quote applies here. She said, now here's a woman who placed her own life, she was literally a military tactician and strategist, and a military officer, going behind what then could be called enemy lines to deliver from direct and certain oppression people who had been enslaved. What did she say? She said, I have saved thousands, I have freed thousands from slavery. I could have freed thousands more if only they knew they were slaves. That is so profound. Our communities, all of our communities, in one way or the other, are malfunctioning, even those that people think are perfect. We have the ready example of what happened in Texas, in North Texas, in McKinney, Texas, where we saw that police officer getting on the back of a black teenage girl, drawing his gun, and all of this is happening supposedly on the basis of a complaint that you had all these black teenagers invading a pool. And somebody called the cops, and this police officer, who also was white, he decided that he was going to behave in the tradition of authority, especially over black people. And so he was caught on camera. He was caught behaving the way he had been enculturated to behave, both as a police officer and as a white man in this country. And people are talking about how outrageous it is that this should happen. And I'm saying to myself, well, where have you been living? What is your familiarity with history of the United States if this is outrageous to you? It means that you are out of touch on a couple of levels. It means that you don't understand the racial order. You don't understand that you are living in an apartheid society. That's one thing. You don't understand that, or you don't accept that as your reality. That's reality. Number two, he's behaving consistent with the culture in which he's working. So what is so shocking about that? And number three, you have to understand, I mean, just a basic understanding of this thing about water and black and white people. It is a really interesting history when you really think about it in America. Black and white people in the same water? No, it was not going to happen here. It's not going to happen. We have entire states that still haven't gotten out of this business about segregated beaches. It's water for everybody. If you don't understand, there's a whole history. I'm sure somebody should write a book about it, about the history of blacks and whites and water, and the brutal ways in which the law was laid down around that. By law, black people could not swim in the same beaches in Florida for decades, by law. And in the same McKinney, Texas, you had fights over public pools, where they were to be located. They're not to be located in the black community, that's for sure, because that is a luxury. To swim is a luxury. And you can't have oppressed black people having the luxury of cooling off in a pool. That disturbs on a psychological level the established order of things. The pools were all located in the better parts of town. Why? Because, number one, your motions, your movement was so regulated in many of these, what we call the sundown cities. Your movement is tracked. Your movement is curtailed. You can't have a whole bunch of people moving from the poor areas into the white middle class areas, and then to commit the ultimate sin of jumping into the same pool with it. Oh, no, no, no. You haven't understood America. You don't get it. The psychological impact has been so deep over these things that most human beings would find almost trivial and laughable, that people had organized themselves, their lives, their whole orientation around these simplistic, non-essential things. But this is our society. And this society taught other societies about how you segregate people, how you control an entire nation with these ridiculous laws. Do you believe that the utter and complete control of the movement of black people in the United States is unrelated to the utter and complete control of people in South Africa and in what was then called Rhodesia, now some Zimbabwe, practically all of colonial Africa, in India and other places beyond? You think these things are unrelated? No. These things are part of the science of oppression. But today you talk to many people who should be very clear about their membership in the oppressed classes, and yet there's pervasive denial. We've come a long way. That was yesterday. Today I have a different scenario to deal with. We have progressed as a nation. And right before you is the unfolding of evidence. Every single day you just go through the headlines and you see that there is no leaving the past, neither for the systems nor for the people controlled by them or enveloped in them. And that is why, again, I say, if you insist that you are not a member of an oppressed class, then you go make an appointment as soon as you possibly can with a really good psychiatrist. 30 years of intensive therapy ought to help you. Systems. We are all parts of systems. Whether they control us, or whether we control those systems, that's the ultimate fight. That's the fight. The system has taken great pains to design what it considers to be ironclad methods of control for a long time, as in perpetuity. They have the advantage of the courts. They have the advantage of tax dollars to do what they want to do. They have the advantage of this, the media, sympathetic media. They have lots of advantages in perpetuating systems of control, ultimate and total control. And we, just inexplicably, we yield to these systems. We give credibility to them. We give them license through our votes. We believe in everything they say. People actually believe Hillary Clinton. The people who ought to be running like hell away from Hillary are fighting each other to get as close to her as possible. I love Hillary. I can't wait till she's president. Demented people. People who really believe that voting makes a difference. The people in McKinney, Texas are voting. And there is a white cop right on the with his knees on the back of a black young woman. With his gun drawn. Because some people didn't want these young people at the pool. We give them license to do these things because we don't understand that there are systems that operate in service of domination and control, which is the American way. And there ought to be systems that we control, which is to create a more humane and just society. There are systems that are working quite well because they are designed to suit the needs of those people who see a need to put some distance between them and the systems of control. They have determined that the system is implementing things and inventing ways of doing things that are a detriment to their progress. So they do the right thing and construct their own systems. I go always to the Amish. Now, people may have whatever opinions they have about the Amish. These are the Mennonite people of Germanic stock who came to the United States and settled in their communities. And what is remarkable is that to a very large extent, they control all important aspects of day-to-day living in their communities. And they don't care what you think. They have their own church. So they are in charge of their own spirituality. They have their own land. So they have, in effect, a sense of nationhood. They have their sovereignty. They make everything they need. So they have a sense of independence from the economy. They have their own economy. They don't use certain things that people think, oh, isn't that so quaint? They don't own cars. They use horses. And they travel. People, oh, is that so quaint? They have their own intelligence about systems. And so they created systems that suit their needs. Whatever you want to think, and you and I, whatever we want to think, whatever our opinions are, it doesn't matter to them. They are living the way they wish to live. They don't vote. They have no desire to participate in that charade, and so they don't. They don't have phones because, it was explained to me, very simple and logical and quite radical. Telephones, they said, I was told, encourage distance from each other. So you can easily pick up the phone and call somebody, your next door neighbor. But the better thing would be to get out of the house and go see your next door neighbor and interact personally with your next door neighbor. So if the phone is going to pose a problem in that sense, creating distance among people, and you really, the higher priority for you, your system says, we must maintain a sense of community, then you look at the phone in a different way. And it doesn't matter what anybody thinks. They grow their own food. So in all of the basic aspects of life that for the outside world is managed and controlled by a system they don't manage and control, within the Amish community, these basic things of daily living are managed and controlled by them. So they have a direct hand in the most important things to them as a community with unique needs. Clearly, in their view, the outside world does not understand what they consider to be their unique needs. So they fashioned systems that do that and do it quite well, quite efficiently. And in fashioning the system, they therefore fashion longevity to their communal existence. They can live as a community for a long time if they hold on to some of these precepts that are built upon their unique needs, what they perceive as their unique needs. That's an extraordinary example. I'm by no means suggesting we all become, Shakers and the Amish. But I'm saying you look at these examples and you see how efficiently they work. Whatever you think is unimportant about that, making a judgment about it. But if you understand their rationale for what they're doing, and you see the direct implementation of the systems that they have designed and devised to suit their own needs, you see, in effect, at work, the concept I'm talking about, fashioning systems that see to your needs. And without having to put up with the nonsense that is surrounding us with these people lying through their teeth all the time. Particularly for members of oppressed classes, it makes sense. To get to the work of creating systems outside of the system that speak to your unique needs and that you control yourself. You're part of the process of real democracy here. Your point of view matters. Your energy is directed at the communal good. And here, I think, is where we have a gaping hole in our communities, which presents the system any number of opportunities to exploit it, and again, never or almost never for our benefit. In the African American community, a simple thing like an invitation to the White House could cause all of your leaders to abandon logic and good causes. That's it. A ride on Air Force One will send them absolutely delirious. And they could be enticed to betray you at the drop of a hat. But if you have no system of controlling these people, if you repeatedly show that they could do anything they wish to do for their own aggrandizement, of course, and at your expense, if there's no consequence to that, you are actually giving legitimacy and giving them license to behave badly and to betray you. We have no consequences. Nobody pays any price for running these oppressed communities further into the ground. There's no price to pay because there's no system that makes them accountable. Which is why the schools could continue to be rotten and why decisions could be made in a haphazard way about the futures of young people. Why there is inadequate housing, substandard qualities of life, why the police are running roughshod in most communities, why the economic infrastructure is not controlled by local people. All these things that are out of order, so out of order, why people are even killing each other at ridiculous rates in Baltimore, in Chicago, in Detroit, in New York City. All of these are signs that of utter failures of systems that ought to be locally controlled, designed by the people to suit the needs of the people. So, are you up to that kind of work? When I ask people, what are you doing? What are your systems? What systems do you belong to? What systems do you have a hand in crafting that speak to the unique needs of your community? How are you fitting into that line of thinking? How are your actions reflecting a consciousness about this? How important is it to you to construct independent systems? In this regard, I would say that progress requires us to regress. Progress requires us to regress. We have to go back to see how extraordinarily insightful and visionary people who suffered even more than we did or ever will, how they constructed systems that allowed them to exist, allowed them to thrive, despite the inordinate blocks in their way, the horrific things they had to contend with. But they understood this. This is their incredible gift to us. We may call it perseverance. We will call it courage. You call it what you want. I call it the fact that they understood systems, bottom line. They understood that they had to devise systems to assure their continued survival and the survival of those behind them. Well, they didn't go to Harvard, and they didn't go to Tuskegee, and they didn't go to Penn State and Michigan State University. But they were brilliant because their reaction to the realities that they knew very well, they were experiencing it every day, compelled them to respond appropriately, which is, I cannot, that system is out to kill me. I'm not going to be part of that. We have to construct something else. We've lost that kind of tenacity and courage. And we think that the answer is out there. Somebody is going to come along and give us the answer. There's no such thing. We are the answers we've been looking for. And we have to construct systems that work for us as we reject systems that do not work for us. Am I making sense to you? I hope so. I hope it makes sense to you. We'll continue this discussion tomorrow because it is important. We've reached a juncture. We just simply cannot continue to go down these roads of self-annihilation. This is the title of one of Amos Wilson's greatest works, Self-Annihilation in Service of White Supremacy. We ought to really get a grip on this because it's literally killing us and causing us to kill ourselves. I'm going to leave it there for today. I thank you for joining me and thank you for the opportunity to just put these ideas before you. I hope we can latch on to them and further explore them in dialogue with each other. But this is important for us to take note of. And if only to get ourselves reoriented about what this business of activism and community involvement, what these things are all about. So thanks for joining me. Keep it right here at PRN.FM. You can drop me a note. I look forward to your notes and letters. I am catching up. I'm really catching up to all the wonderful things that you have sent my way at leadstories@gmail.com. Keep it right here at PRN, your favorite station. A pleasure and a great, great privilege to be in your esteemed company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye. The other.